This is an example of the hierarchical organization of the gods, a concept frequently encapsulated in mythology, and one we shall return to later. All the original children of Tiamat are potent and impersonal elder gods, psychological forces, the deities that eternally rule or constitute human motivation and affect. The question of the proper ordering of those forces, who or what should rule, is the central problem of morality and the primary problem facing human individuals and social organizations. The Sumerian solution to this problem was the elevation of Marduk, the sun god who voluntarily faces chaos, to the position of king, and the subjugation of the other gods to that king. Anshar opened his mouth and addressed these words to Kaka, his vizier. "Kaka, my vizier, who gladdenest my heart, unto Lamu and Lahamu I will send thee. Thou knowest how to discern, and art able to relate. Cause the gods, my fathers, to be brought before me. Let them bring all the gods to me. Let them converse and sit down to banquet. Let them eat bread and prepare wine. For Marduk, their avenger, let them decree the destiny. Set out, O Kaka, go, and stand thou before them. What I am about to tell thee, repeat unto them. Anshar, your son, has sent me. The command of his heart he has charged me to convey, saying, Tiamat, our bearer, hates us. She held a meeting and raged furiously. All the gods went over to her. Even those who ye have created march at her side. They separated themselves and went over to the side of Tiamat. They were angry. They plotted, not resting day or night. They took up the fight, fuming and raging. They held a meeting and planned the conflict. Mother Huber, Tiamat, who fashions all things, added thereto irresistible weapons, bearing monster serpents sharp of tooth and not sparing the fang. With poison instead of blood she filled their bodies. Ferocious dragons she clothed with terror. She crowned them with fear-inspiring glory and made them like gods, so that they might cause him who would look upon them to perish from terror, so that their bodies might leap forward and none turn back their breasts. She set up the viper, the dragon, and the lahumum, the great lion, the mad dog, and the scorpion man, driving storm demons, the dragonfly, and the bison, bearing unsparing weapons, unafraid of battle. Powerful are her decrees, irresistible are they. Altogether, 11 kinds of monsters of this sort she brought into being. Of those among the gods, her firstborn who formed her assembly, she exalted Kingu. In their midst she made him great, to march at the head of the army, to direct the forces, to raise the weapons for the engagement, to launch the attack, the high command of the battle. She entrusted to his hand. She caused him to sit in the assembly, saying, I have cast the spell for thee. I have made thee great in the assembly of the gods. The dominion over all the gods I have given into thy hand. Mayest thou be highly exalted, thou, my unique spouse. May thy names become greater than those of the Anunnaki. She gave him the tablet of destinies. She fastened it upon his breast, saying, As for thee, thy command shall not be changed. The word of thy mouth shall be dependable. Now, when Kingu had been exalted and had received supreme dominion, they decreed the destinies of the gods, her sons, saying, May the opening of our mouths quiet the fire god. May thy overpowering poison vanquish the opposing night. I sent Anu, but he could not face her. E also was afraid and turned back. Then Marduk, the wisest of the gods, your son, came forward. His heart prompted him to face Tiamat. He opened his mouth and said to me, If I am indeed to be your avenger, to vanquish Tiamat and to keep you alive, convene the assembly and proclaim my lot supreme. When ye are joyfully seated together in the court of assembly, may I, through the utterance of my mouth, determine the destinies instead of you. Whatever I create shall remain unaltered. The command of my lips shall not return void, it shall not be changed. Hasten to me, then, and speedily fix for him your destiny, that he may go to meet your powerful enemy. The hierarchical organization of the gods is represented schematically in Figure 21, World of Gods, Hierarchical Organization, which portrays Marduk as the superordinate personality or pattern of action designed to transform the unbearable present into the desired future. The Enuma Elish states, essentially, when things are normal, any god might rule. However, in the case of a true crisis, everyone turns to the sun god, the embodiment of consciousness. Perhaps it is reasonable to presume, therefore, that he should always reign supreme. The formulation of this hypothesis was a work of unsurpassed genius and a decisive move in the history of the Western mind. The vizier Kaka goes on his way, as commanded, and spreads the word among the secondary patriarchal elder deities, who assemble to contemplate the upcoming battle. They entered into the presence of Anshar and filled the court of assembly. They kissed one another as they came together in the assembly. They conversed and sat down to a banquet. They ate bread and prepared wine. The sweet wine dispelled their fears. Their bodies swelled as they drank the strong drink. Exceedingly carefree were they. Their spirit was exalted. For Marduk, their avenger, they decreed the destiny. They erected for him a lordly throne dais, and he took his place before his fathers to receive sovereignty. Thou art the most important among the great gods. Thy destiny is unequaled. Thy command is like that of Anu. Marduk, thou art the most important among the great gods. Thy destiny is unequaled. Thy command is like that of Anu. From this day onward, thy command shall not be changed, to exalt and abase. This shall be thy power. Dependable shall be the utterance of thy mouth. Thy command shall not prove vain. None among the gods shall infringe upon thy prerogative. The gods place the starry garment of the night sky in their midst. At the command of Marduk's mouth, on his word it appears, at his command it disappears, as the night sky on the passage of the sun. Marduk is clearly part of the pantheon who eternally vanquish the dragon of the night. The story continues. When the gods, his fathers, beheld the power of his word, they were glad and did homage, saying, Marduk is king. They bestowed upon him the scepter, the throne, and the royal robe. They gave him an irresistible weapon, smiting the enemy, saying, Go and cut off the life of Tiamat. May the winds carry her blood to out-of-the-way places. After the gods, his fathers, had determined the destiny of Marduk, they set him on the road, the way to success and attainment. Marduk gathers his armaments, bow, club, and lightning, sets himself ablaze, and fashions a net to enclose Tiamat. He is a master of fire and armaments, which is to say, a master of the technology that serves most fundamentally to transform the unknown and terrifying world into the comforting, productive, and familiar. He is able to bind the unknown, to limit its sphere of action, and to bring it under control. He raises the winds and the storm to aid him, using the forces of nature against nature itself. He dresses himself in a terrifying coat of mail and wears terror-inspiring splendor on his head. Prepared carefully in this manner and fortified against poison, he takes the direct route to Tiamat. He confronts re-emergent novelty voluntarily at a time of his choosing after careful preparation and without avoidance. His mere appearance strikes terror into the heart of Kingu and his legion of monsters, just as Christ, much later, terrifies the devil and his minions. Marduk confronts Tiamat, accuses her of treachery, and challenges her to battle. When Tiamat heard this, she became like one in a frenzy and lost her reason. Tiamat cried out loud and furiously. To the very roots, her two legs shook back and forth. She recites an incantation, repeatedly casting her spell. As for the gods of battle, they sharpen their weapons. Tiamat and Marduk, the wisest of the gods, advanced against one another. They pressed on to single combat. They approached for battle. Marduk fills Tiamat with an evil wind, which distends her belly. When she opens her mouth to devour him, he lets an arrow fly, which tears her interior and splits her heart. He subdues her completely, casts down her carcass, and stands upon it. His voluntary encounter with the forces of the unknown produces a decisive victory. He rounds up her subordinates, including Kingu, whom he deprives of the Tablet of Destinies, and encapsulates them with netting. Then he returns to Tiamat. The Lord trod upon the hinder part of Tiamat, and with his unsparing club he split her skull. He cut the arteries of her blood and caused the north wind to carry it to out-of-the-way places. He split her open like a muscle into two parts. Half of her he set in place and formed the sky therewith as a roof. He fixed the crossbar and posted guards. He commanded them not to let her waters escape. He crossed the heavens and examined the regions. He placed himself opposite the Apsu, the dwelling of E. The Lord measured the dimensions of the Apsu, and a great structure he established, namely Ishera, earth. Marduk then constructs the heavenly order, fashioning the year, defining the 12-sign zodiac, determining the movement of the stars, the planets, and the moon. Finally, he deigns to create man, out of Kingu, the greatest and most guilty of Tiamat's allies, so that upon him shall the services of the gods be imposed, that they may be at rest. Then he returns the gods allied with him to their appropriate celestial abodes. Grateful, they deliver him a present. Now, O Lord, who hast established our freedom from compulsory service, what shall be the sign of our gratitude before thee? Come, let us make something whose name shall be called sanctuary. It shall be a dwelling for our rest at night. Come, let us repose therein. The dwelling is Babylon, center of civilization, mythic sacred space dedicated in perpetuity to Marduk. The mythic tale of the Enuma Elish describes the nature of the eternal relationship between the unknowable source of all things, the gods who rule human life, and the subject or process who constructs determinate experience through voluntary encounter with the unknown. The full story presented in the Sumerian creation myth is presented schematically in Figure 22, the Enuma Elish in schematic representation. Tiamat is portrayed simultaneously as the thing that breeds everything, as the mother of all the gods, as the thing that destroys all things, as the consort of a patriarchal spiritual principle upon whom creation also depends, Apsu, and finally, as the thing that is cut into pieces by the hero who constructs the world. Marduk, the last-born child of instinct, is the hero who voluntarily faces the creative, destructive power that constitutes the place from which all things emerge. He is the martial deity, role model for the culture of the West, who violently carves the unknown into pieces and makes the predictable world from those pieces. This tale contains within it a complex and sophisticated notion of causality. None of its elements exist in contradiction with any other, even though each lays stress on different aspects of the same process. Something must exist prior to the construction of identifiable things, something that cannot be imagined in the absence of a subject. That thing might usefully be portrayed as the all-devouring mother of everything. The particular, discriminable, familiar elements of human experience exist as they do, however, because the conscious subject can detect, construct, and transform them. The sun hero's role in the birth of things is therefore as primal as the mother's, although this part is somewhat more difficult to comprehend. Nonetheless, the Sumerians managed the representation in narrative form. It is a relatively small step from this dramatic imagistic portrayal of the hero to the most explicit Christian doctrine of logos, the creative word, and from there to our notion of consciousness. The mythic tale of Marduk and Tiamat refers to the capacity of the individual to explore voluntarily and to bring things into being as a consequence. The hero cuts the world of the unpredictable, unexplored territory, signified by Tiamat, into its distinguishable elements, weaves a net of determinate meaning capable of encompassing the vast unknown, embodies the divine masculine essence, which has as its most significant feature the capacity to transform chaos into order. The killing of an all-embracing monster and the construction of the universe from its body parts is symbolic, metaphorical representation of the central adaptive process of heroic encounter with the undifferentiated unknown and the construction or generation of differentiated order as a consequence. It is this process, emulated by the emperor of Mesopotamia, who richly embodied Marduk, that served as the basis for his authority. And, indeed, that serves to undergird the idea of lawful authority to the present day. The Mesopotamian emperor's identification with the most divine of all the deities, according to the judgment and election of those self-same powers, lent him power and served to maintain social and psychological order among his people. Furthermore, the Mesopotamian emperor stood in the same relationship to his people as Marduk stood to him, as a ritual model for emulation, as the personality whose actions served as pattern for all actions undertaken in the kingdom, as the personality that was the state, insofar as the state defined and brought order to interpersonal interactions, which, after all, was and is its primary function. Babylon was therefore conceptualized as the kingdom of God on earth, that is, as a profane imitation of heaven. The emperor served this imitated heaven as the imitator of Marduk, at least insofar as he was conservative, just, courageous, and creative. Mircea Eliade comments on the sacrality of the Mesopotamian sovereign and describes the rituals designed to maintain that sacrality. Thus, at Babylon, the Enuma Elish was recited in the temple on the fourth day of the New Year festival. This festival, named Zagmuk, beginning of the year in Sumerian, and Akitu in Akkadian, note, the Sumerians and Akkadians united to form Babylon, took place during the first 12 days of the month of Nisan. It comprised several sequences, of which we will mention the most important. Number 1, a day of expiation for the king corresponding to Marduk's captivity. Number 2, the freeing of Marduk. Number 3, ritual combats and a triumphal procession led by the king to the Bit Akitu, the house of the New Year festival, where a banquet was held. Number 4, the hieros gamos, mystical marriage of the king with a hierodual, ritual slave prostitute personifying the goddess, and number 5, the determination of destinies by the gods. The meaning of some terminology and the nature of the latter two sequences must be clarified here. First, with regard to number 4, it should be noted that hieros gamos means mystical marriage, the marriage of the king and the queen or goddess. This marriage provides dramatic representation of the union of the exploratory tendency, incarnated by the king, with the positive aspect of the unknown, incarnated by the hierodual. Marduk, the king, is originally shut up, signifying his temporary disappearance. See the description of Osiris below. during the normal or routinized operations of the state. He is freed to meet Tiamat. He does so in sexual union. This sexual, read creative union, the juxtaposition of the process of knowing embodied by the king, Marduk, with the unknown embodied by Tiamat, incarnated by the Hierodule, is what gives rise to the generation of new information and patterns of adaptation. The process of generating knowledge is therefore assimilated to the domain of sexual union as the primordial creative process. The deity of chaos, or the unknown, appears most generally as feminine and as half-negative and half-positive, once the initial division between order and chaos has been established. The attribution of femininity to this deity, so to speak, occurs most fundamentally because the unknown serves as the matrix from which determinate forms are born. The negative attribution, Tiamat serves as example, exists because the unknown has a destructive aspect. The positive, the Hierodule here, Isis in the Egyptian myth of Osiris, Mary in Christianity, because the unknown is also creative or generative. Second, with regard to number 5. It should be noted that the king, in his incarnation as God, served to determine destinies because he was both hero, ritual model for emulation, and absolute ruler. As such, he literally controlled individual destinies, serving as he did, practically and in representation, as the most powerful individual in society and the most dominant strategy in the hierarchy of behavioral adaptation. What he could not determine by law, however, he was to provide by creative example, since the body of laws, as embodiment of past wisdom, is insufficient to deal with the challenges of the present. This idea is developed much more explicitly by the Egyptians, as we shall see. Back to Iliades' story. The first sequence of this mythico-ritual scenario, the king's humiliation and Marduk's captivity, indicates the regression of the world to the pre-cosmogonic chaos. In the sanctuary of Marduk, the high priest stripped the king of his emblems, scepter, ring, scimitar, and crown, and struck him in the face. Then, on his knees, the king uttered a declaration of innocence. "I have not sinned, O Lord of the lands. I have not been negligent regarding thy divinity." The high priest, speaking in Marduk's name, replied, "Do not fear. Marduk will hear thy prayer. He will increase thy dominion." During this time, the people sought for Marduk, supposed to be shut up in the mountain, a formula indicating the death of a divinity, in consequence of a descent far from the sun and light. When the world regresses to pre-cosmogonic chaos, it is always the case that the hero is missing. The hero is, after all, incarnation of the process by which chaos is transformed into order. If chaos has the upper hand, it is by definition because of a current paucity of heroism. It can be said, therefore, that the reappearance of the Great Mother in her terrible guise, the death of the Great Father, who serves as protection from his creative and destructive wife, and the absence of the hero who turns chaos into order, all represent different ways of telling the same story, the story which describes a life-threatening imbalance in the powers of the constituent elements of experience. Eliade continues, describing the rediscovery or reemergence of Marduk. "Finally, he was delivered, and the gods assembled, that is, their statues were brought together, to determine the destinies." This episode corresponds, in the Enuma Elish, to Marduk's advancement to the rank of supreme god. The king led the procession to the Bit Akitu, a building situated outside of the city, outside the domain of civilization or order. The procession represented the army of the gods advancing against Tiamat. According to an inscription of Sennacherib, we may suppose that the primordial battle was mimed, the king personifying Assur, the god who had replaced Marduk. The Hieros Gamos took place after the return from the banquet at the Bit Akitu. The last act consisted in the determination of the destinies for each month of the year. By determining it, the year was ritually created. That is, the good fortune, fertility, and richness of the new world that had just been born were ensured. The role of the king in the Akitu is inadequately known. His humiliation corresponds to the regression of the world to chaos and to Marduk's captivity in the mountain. The king personifies the god in the battle against Tiamat and in the Hieros Gamos with a hierodule. But identification with the god is not always indicated. As we have seen, during his humiliation, the king addresses Marduk. Nevertheless, the sacrality of the Mesopotamian sovereign is amply documented. Though the king recognized his earthly begetting, he was considered a son of God. This twofold descent made him supremely the intermediary between gods and men. The sovereign represented the people before the gods, and it was he who expiated the sins of his subjects. Sometimes he had to suffer death for his people's crimes. This is why the Assyrians had a substitute for the king. The texts proclaim that the king had lived in fellowship with the gods in the fabulous garden that contains the tree of life and the water of life. The king is the envoy of the gods, the shepherd of the people, named by God to establish justice and peace on earth. It could be said that the king shared in the divine modality, but without becoming a god. He represented the god, and this, on the archaic levels of culture, also implied that he was, in a way, he whom he personified. In any case, as mediator between the world of men and the world of the gods, the Mesopotamian king effected in his own person a ritual union between the two modalities of existence, the divine and the human. It was by virtue of this twofold nature that the king was considered, at least metaphorically, to be the creator of life and fertility. Marduk, in his manifestation as Nam-Tilaku, was also the god who restores to life, who can restore all ruined gods as though they were his own creation, the lord who by holy incantation restores the dead gods to life. This idea echoes through ancient Egyptian theology, as described below. Marduk was Namshub as well, the bright god who brightens our way, which once again assimilates him to the sun, and Aseru, the god of resurrection, who causes the green herb to spring up. Whatever Marduk represents was also considered central to creation of rich abundance, to mercy and justice, to familial love, and, most interestingly, to the creation of ingenious things from the conflict with Tiamat. He was in fact addressed by 50 names by the Mesopotamians. Each name signified an independent, valuable attribute or property, likely at one time separate gods, now regarded as clearly dependent for its existence upon him. It seems evident that the attribution of these 50 names to Marduk parallels the movement toward monotheism described in the Enuma Elish itself, with all the gods organizing themselves voluntarily under Marduk's dominion, and occurring in Mesopotamian society at the human and historical level. It might be said that the Mesopotamians came to realize, in ritual and image at least, that all the life-sustaining processes that they worshipped in representation were secondary aspects of the exploratory, creative, rejuvenating process embodied by Marduk. A similar pattern of ritual and secondary conceptualization characterized ancient Egyptian society. In the earliest Egyptian cosmology, circa 2700 BC, the god Ptah, a spiritualized manifestation of Adam, the all-encircling serpent, creates by his mind, his heart, and his word, his tongue. Iliada states, Ptah is proclaimed the greatest god Adam being considered only the author of the first divine couple. It is Ptah who made the gods exist. In short, the theogony and the cosmogony are effected by the creative power of the thought and word of a single god. We here certainly have the highest expression of Egyptian metaphysical speculation. As John Wilson observes, it is at the beginning of Egyptian history that we find a doctrine that can be compared with the Christian theology of the Logos, or Word. The Egyptians realized that consciousness and linguistic ability were vital to the existence of things, precisely as vital as the unknowable matrix of their being. This idea still has not fully permeated our explicit understanding, since we attribute the existence of things purely to their material substrate, despite its centrality to Christian thinking. The Egyptians viewed Ptah, the spermatic word, as the original or primordial, read heavenly, king. As in Mesopotamia, essentially, he ceded this power in the earthly domain to his successor, the pharaoh, his actual or literal son from the Egyptian viewpoint, as the pharaoh was viewed as God. The creative power thus transferred was literally defined by the Egyptians as the ability to put order, mat, in the place of chaos. Iliadic comments. It is these same terms that are used of Tutankhamun when he restored order after the heresy of Akhenaton or of Pepi II. He put mat at the place of falsehood, of disorder. Similarly, the verb k, to shine, is used indifferently to depict the emergence of the sun at the moment of creation or at each dawn, and the appearance of the pharaoh at the coronation ceremony, at festivals, or at the privy council. The pharaoh is the incarnation of mat, a term translated by truth, but whose general meaning is good order and hence right. Justice. Mat belongs to the original creation, hence it reflects the perfection of the Golden Age. Since it constitutes the very foundation of the cosmos and life, mat can be known by each individual separately. In texts of different origins and periods, there are such declarations as these. Incite your heart to know mat. I make thee to know the thing of mat in thy heart. Mayest thou do what is right for thee. Or, I was a man who loved mat and hated sin, for I knew that sin is an abomination to God. And in fact, it is God who bestows the necessary knowledge. A prince is defined as one who knows truth, mat, and whom God teaches. The author of a prayer to Re cries, Mayest thou give me mat in my heart. As incarnating mat, the pharaoh constitutes the paradigmatic example for all his subjects. As the vizier Rekh-mi-Re expresses it, he is a god who makes us live by his acts. The work of the pharaoh ensures the stability of the cosmos and the state, and hence the continuity of life. And, indeed, the cosmogony is repeated every morning when the solar god repels the serpent Apophis, though without being able to destroy him. For chaos, equals the original darkness, represents virtuality. Hence it is indestructible. The pharaoh's political activity repeats Ray's exploit. He too repels Apophis. In other words, he sees to it that the world does not return to chaos. When enemies appear at the frontiers, they will be assimilated to Apophis, the god of primordial chaos, and the pharaoh's victory will reproduce Ra's triumph. The ideas of kingship, creativity, and renewal are given a different and more sophisticated slant in the central myth of Osiris, which served as an alternate basis for Egyptian theology. The story of Osiris and his son Horus is much more complex in some ways than the Mesopotamian creation myth or the story of Re, and describes the interactions between the constituent elements of experience in exceedingly compressed form. Osiris was a primeval king, a legendary ancestral figure who ruled Egypt wisely and fairly. His evil brother, Seth, whom he did not understand, rose up against him. Figure 23, the battle between Osiris and Seth in the domain of order, portrays this conflict as a war in the heavenly domain of order. Seth kills Osiris, that is, sends him to the underworld, and dismembers his body so that it can never be found. Figure 24, the involuntary descent and disintegration of Osiris, portrays Osiris' involuntary descent and disintegration and his quasi-existence in the underworld of chaos. The death of Osiris signifies two important things. One, the tendency of a static ruling idea, system of valuation, or particular story, no matter how initially magnificent or appropriate, to become increasingly irrelevant with time. And, two, the dangers that necessarily accrue to a state that forgets or refuses to admit to the existence of the immortal deity of evil. Seth, the king's brother and opposite, represents the mythic hostile twin or adversary who eternally opposes the process of creative encounter with the unknown. Signifies, alternatively speaking, a pattern of adaptation characterized by absolute opposition to establishment of divine order. When this principle gains control, that is, usurps the throne, the rightful king and his kingdom are necessarily doomed. Seth, and figures like him, often represented in narrative by the corrupt right-hand man or advisor to the once great king, view human existence itself with contempt. Such figures are motivated only to protect or advance their position in the power hierarchy, even when the prevailing order is clearly counterproductive. Their actions necessarily speed the process of decay endemic to all structures. Osiris, although great, was naive in some profound sense, blind at least to the existence of immortal evil. This blindness and its resultant incaution brings about, or at least hastens, Osiris' demise. Osiris has a wife, as befits the king of order. Isis, as Osiris' mythic counterpart, is representative of the positive aspect of the unknown, like the hierodule in the Mesopotamian New Year's ritual. She is possessed of great magical powers, as might be expected, given her status. She gathers up Osiris' scattered pieces and makes herself pregnant with the use of his dismembered phallus. This story makes a profound point. The degeneration of the state or domain of order and its descent into chaos serves merely to fructify that domain and to make it pregnant. In chaos lurks great potential. When a great organization disintegrates, falls into pieces, the pieces might still usefully be fashioned into or give rise to something else, perhaps something more vital and still greater. Isis therefore gives birth to a son, Horus, who returns to his rightful kingdom to confront his evil uncle. This process is schematically represented in Figure 25, the birth and return of Horus, divine son of order and chaos. Horus fights a difficult battle with Seth, as the forces of evil are difficult to overcome, and loses an eye in the process. Seth is overcome nonetheless. Horus recovers his eye. The story could stop there, narrative integrity intact, with the now whole and victorious Horus's well-deserved ascension to the throne. However, Horus does the unexpected, descending voluntarily to the underworld to find his father, as portrayed schematically in Figure 26, Voluntary Encounter with the Underworld. It is representation of this move, reminiscent of Marduk's voluntary journey to the underworld of Tiamat, that constitutes the brilliant and original contribution of Egyptian theology. Horus discovers Osiris, extant in a state of torpor. He offers his recovered eye to his father so that Osiris can see once again. They return united and victorious and establish a revivified kingdom. The kingdom of the son and father is an improvement over that of the father or the son alone, as it unites the hard-won wisdom of the past, that is, of the dead, with the adaptive capacity of the present, that is, of the living. The re-establishment and improvement of the domain of order is schematically represented in Figure 27, ascent and reintegration of the father. In the story of Osiris, the senescence/death of the father, presented as a consequence of the treachery of Seth, is overcome by the mythic son, the hero who temporarily defeats the power of evil and who rejuvenates the father. Marduk, the Mesopotamian supreme god, is by comparison a straightforward hero. He carves the familiar world from the unfamiliar. Horus, equally brave, is more complete and more sophisticated. He cannot remain content with his own ascension, feeling himself incomplete without his father. He therefore journeys voluntarily into the underworld, releases the disintegrated forces of tradition trapped there, and makes them part of himself. This pattern of behavior constitutes an elaboration of that represented by Marduk, or of Re, the Egyptian sun god. Marduk creates order from chaos. That capacity, which is theoretically embodied in the form of the Mesopotamian emperor, lends temporal authority its rightful power. The same idea, elaborated substantially, applies in Egypt. Osiris constitutes the old state, once great but dangerously anachronistic. Horus partakes of the essence of tradition, he is the son of his father, but is vivified by an infusion of new information. His mother, after all, is the positive aspect of the unknown. As an updated version of his father, he is capable of dealing with the problems of the present, that is, with the emergent evil represented by his uncle. Victorious over his uncle, he is nonetheless incomplete, as his youthful spirit lacks the wisdom of the past. So, he journeys into the unknown where his father rests, lifeless, that is, uncomprehended, without embodiment or incarnation in action in the present. Horus unites himself with his father and becomes the ideal ruler, the consciousness of present youthful life, conjoined with the wisdom of tradition. The dead Egyptian pharaoh, that is, the ruler whose death preceded the ascension of the current pharaoh, was assimilated to, occupied the same categorical space as, Osiris. That meant he was regarded as equivalent to the spirit that founded the state, the archetypal creator god or legendary ancestor whose courageous actions had cosmogonic significance. The current ruler, who depended for much of his power on the traditions of his predecessors, modified when necessary, was regarded as equivalent to Horus and to Re, the sun god. The ruling pharaoh was therefore the power that generated order from chaos, as Re, and the power that rejuvenated order once it had degenerated into unthinking authoritarianism or too rigid and blind tradition. Furthermore, however, he was the rejuvenated Osiris, who was the dead pharaoh, so he was tradition given sight. The sophistication of this idea of reputable leadership, creative power, regenerative power, and revivified tradition, can hardly be regarded as anything but remarkable. It is also of overwhelming historical interest and modern relevance that the Egyptians increasingly came to regard Osiris Horus as an exemplar not just of the pharaoh, but of every individual in the kingdom. Iliada states with regard to later Egyptian burial practice. The texts formerly inscribed on the walls of the hidden chambers in the pyramids erected for the pharaohs are now reproduced inside the coffins of the nobility and even of totally unprivileged people. Osiris becomes the model for all those who hope to conquer death. A coffin text proclaims, "Thou art now the son of a king, a prince, as long as thy heart, i.e. spirit, shall be with thee." Following Osiris's example, and with his help, the dead are able to transform themselves into souls. That is, into perfectly integrated and hence indestructible spiritual beings. Murdered and dismembered, Osiris was reconstituted by Isis and reanimated by Horus. In this way, he inaugurated a new mode of existence. From a powerless shade, he became a person who knows, a duly initiated spiritual being. This development might also be regarded as an illustration of the increasing psychologization, abstraction, and internalization of religious ideation. In the earliest stages of representation, deities are viewed as pluralistic and as individualistic and fractious members of a supra-celestial, that is, transpersonal and immortal, community. Later, they are integrated into a hierarchy as the culture becomes more integrated, more sure about relative valuation and moral virtue, and a single god with a multitude of related features comes to dominate. Development of monotheism thus parallels intrapsychic and intracultural moral integration. As the average citizen identifies more and more clearly with this monotheistic integrated pattern, its external nature as an attribute of the gods recedes. It becomes more clearly an attribute of the individual human being, and more like what we would conceive of as a psychological trait. The god's subjective aspect, his or her intrapsychic quality, becomes more evident, at least to the most sophisticated of intuitions, and the possibility of personal relationship with the deity emerges as a prospect at the conceptual level of analysis. The process is just beginning in abstraction in Mesopotamia and Egypt. The ancient Israelites bring it most clearly to fruition with potent and lasting effect. It does not seem unreasonable to regard this development as a precursor to the Christian Revolution, which granted every individual the status of Son of God and as implicitly akin to our modern notion of the intrinsic human right. The Egyptian pharaoh, like the Mesopotamian king, served as material incarnation of the process that separates order from chaos. Simultaneously, the pharaoh king literally embodied the state. Finally, the pharaoh king was the rejuvenator of his own father. The ideal pharaoh king was therefore the exploratory process that gave rise to the state itself, and the revivifying exploratory process that updated the state when it was in danger of too conservative ossification. This massively complex and sophisticated conceptualization is given added breadth and depth by consideration of its psychological element. The state is not merely cultural, it is also spiritual. As custom and tradition is established, it is inculcated into each individual and becomes part of their intrapsychic structure. The state is therefore personality and social organization simultaneously. Personality and social order conjoined in the effort to keep the terror of chaos at bay, or, better still, united in the effort to make something positively useful of it. This means that the hero king who establishes, embodies, and updates the social world is also the same force that establishes, embodies, and updates the intrapsychic world, the personality, and that one act of update cannot necessarily or reasonably be distinguished from the other. In improving the world, the hero improves himself. In improving himself, he sets an example for the world. Initially, The personality of state was in fact a ritual human model, a hero to observe and imitate, an entity represented in behavioral pattern. Then a story about such ritual models, an entity represented in imagination. And, finally, and only much later, an abstract construction of rules describing the explicit rights and responsibilities of the citizenry, an entity of words, the body of law. This increasingly abstract and detailed construction develops from imitation to abstract representation and comprises rules and schemas of interpretations useful for maintaining stability of interpersonal interaction. The establishment of these rules and schemas gives determinate meaning to human experience by bringing predictability to all social situations, to all things encountered interpersonally. The same thing might be said from the psychological perspective. It is incorporation of the personality of state, dominated by the figure of the hero, that brings order to the inner community of necessity and desire, to the generative chaos of the soul. The Mesopotamian culture hero slash deity, Marduk, represents the capacity of the process of exploration to generate the world of experience. The Egyptian gods, Horus, Osiris, represent the extended version of that capacity, which means not only generation of the world from the unknown, but transformation of the pattern of adaptation which constitutes the known when such transformation becomes necessary. Sometimes, adaptation is merely a matter of the adjustment of the means to an end. More rarely, but equally necessarily, adaptation is reconceptualization of what is known, unbearable present, desirable future, and means to attain such, because what is known is out of date, and therefore deadly. It is the sum of these processes that manifests itself in the Judeo-Christian tradition as the mythic Word of God, and which is embodied in Christ, the Christian culture hero. This is the force that generates subject and object from the primordial chaos, and, therefore, which predates the existence of both. The force that engenders the tradition that makes vulnerable existence possible in the face of constant mortal threat, and the force that updates protective tradition when it has become untenable and tyrannical on account of its age. The Sumerian and Egyptian myths portray ideas of exceeding complexity in ritual, drama, and imagistic form. This form is not purposeful mystification, but the manner in which ideas emerge before they are sufficiently developed to be explicitly comprehensible. We acted out and provisionally formulated complete, impressionistic models of the world of experience, which was the world we always had to understand, long before the contents of such models could be understood in the way we currently conceive of understanding. Brief analysis of the Sumerian and Egyptian theologies and of the relationship of those theologies to political action shed substantial light on the manner in which many of our most important modern ideas developed, and on what those ideas actually mean. This understanding, derived from two or three specific examples, can be further enhanced through more general discussion. We therefore turn our attention from analysis of complete stories, which have as their advantage a more compelling nature, to detailed description of the mythological characters whose essence and interactions constitute the world. The totality of the world, which includes the significance of experienced things as well as the things themselves, is composed of what has been explored and rendered familiar, what has yet to be encountered and is therefore unpredictable, and the process that mediates between the two. One final element must be additionally considered. The state of being that includes or precedes the division of everything into these three constituent elements. This state might be regarded as the true source of all things, subjects and objects, the single ancestor and final destination of all. The complete mythological world of experience is portrayed schematically in Figure 28, the constituent elements of experience as personality, territory, and process. Our discussion turns first to the diverse nature of representations of the original undifferentiated state, the condition of primordial chaos, and then to a more elaborated description of its children, the divine parents, nature and culture, and the divine son, simultaneously child, primal creator, and eternal adversary. The Dragon of Primordial Chaos. The source of things is the boundless. From whence they arise, thence they must also of necessity return. For they do penance and make compensation to one another for their injustice in the order of time. Anaximander of Miletus. It might seem futile to speculate about the nature of that which existed prior to any experience, or that which has not yet been explored. Futile or not, such speculation has occupied a good portion of man's time as he attempted to understand the mystery of his emergence and of the world he found himself occupying. It seems impossible to determine what it is that was before anything was. Myth attempts that task, despite its impossibility. It does so using the tool of metaphor. The metaphorical statements of myth work because unknown or partially known things inevitably share characteristics of importance with somewhat more thoroughly investigated, comprehended, and familiar things. Two or more objects or situations come to occupy the same mythological or categorical space, therefore, because they share similar form, function, or capacity to induce affect and compel behavior. A mandrake root, for example, has the nature of a man, symbolically speaking, because it has the shape of a man. Mars is a warlike planet because it is red, and red, the color of blood, is associated indelibly with aggression. The metal, mercury, and the spirit that inhabits it is akin to seawater, because both may serve as solvents or agents of transformation. The dark and the animal of the forest are the same, because they are both unfamiliar, because they both inhibit ongoing behavior when they make their appearance, because they both cause fear. Metaphor links thing to thing, situation to situation, concentrating on the phenomenological, affective, functional, and motivational features the linked situations share. Through such linkage, what might otherwise remain entirely mysterious can begin to become comprehended. Myths of the origin metaphorically portray the nature of the infinite potential that characterized being prior to the dawn of experience. This general symbolic construction takes many particular forms, each of which might be said to constitute a partial attempt to represent the unrepresentable whole. These particular forms range in nature from the specific and concrete to the general and abstract, and are influenced in their development by the environmental and cultural conditions obtaining at the time of their emergence. The process of metaphorical representation provides a bridge, and an increasingly communicable bridge, between what can be directly explored, experienced, and comprehended, and what remains eternally unknown. Mythic symbols of the chaos of the beginning are imaginative pictures, whose purpose is representation of a paradoxical totality, a state, which is already to say something too determinate, self-contained, uniform, and complete, where everything now distinct resides in union. A state where being and non-being, beginning and end, matter and energy, spirit and body, consciousness and unconsciousness, femininity and masculinity, night and day, remain compounded prior to the discrimination into the separable elements of experience. In this state, all conceivable pairs of opposites and contradictory forces exist together within the all-encompassing embrace of an omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, and altogether mysterious God. This paradisal precondition, lacking nothing, characterized by absolute completion, exists in contradistinction to the profane world, imperfect and partial, suspended unbearably in time and in space. It surrounds that world completely, like the night surrounds the day, comprising the beginning of things, the fountainhead for everything, and, similarly, the resting place and destination point for all. The seminal psychologist William James turned to poetry in his attempt to conceptualize this place. No verbiage can give it, because the verbiage is other. Incoherent, coherent, same. And it fades, and it's infinite, and it's infinite. Don't you see the difference? Don't you see the identity? Constantly opposites united. The same me telling you to write and not to write. Extreme, extreme, extreme. Something and other than that thing. Intoxication and otherness than intoxication. Every attempt at betterment, every attempt at otherment is a... It fades forever and forever as we move. This state, the totality of all things, might be regarded as the objective world in the absence of the subject, although this conceptualization is too narrow, as primordial chaos also contains that which evolves into the subject when it is differentiated. What might be regarded as the standard objective viewpoint is predicated on the idea that things as they are perceived exist regardless of the perceiver. From a certain perspective, this is true. Things have a nature that appears independent of subjective will and follow their own laws of being and development, despite our wishes. However, the job of determining what a thing is in the absence of the subject is much more difficult than might initially be imagined. It is certainly the case, as we have seen, that the value of an object can shift with shifts in frame of reference. It appears to be true, however, that what an object is and of itself, is also subject to such shift. Any given object, a table, say, exists as a table because it is apprehended only in a very limited and restrained manner. Something is a table at a particular and isolated level of analysis, specified by the nature of the observer. In the absence of this observer, one might ask, what is it that is being apprehended? Is the proper level of analysis and specification subatomic, atomic, or molecular, or all three at once? Should the table be considered an indistinguishable element of the Earth upon which it rests, or of the solar system which contains the Earth, or of the galaxy itself? The same problem obtains from the perspective of temporality. What is now table was once tree, before that Earth, before that rock, before that star. What is now table also has before it an equally complex and lengthy developmental history waiting in front of it. It will be, perhaps, ash, then earth, then, far enough in the future, part of the sun again, when the sun finally re-envelops the earth. The table is what it is only at a very narrow span of spatial and temporal resolution, the span that precisely characterizes our consciousness. So what is the table as an independent object, free, that is, of the restrictions that characterize the evidently limited human viewpoint? What is it that can be conceptualized at all spatial and temporal levels of analysis simultaneously? Does the existence of the thing include its interactions with everything it influences and is influenced by, gravitationally and electromagnetically? Is that thing everything it once was, everything it is, and everything it will be, all at the same time? Where, then, are its borders? How can it be distinguished from other things? And, without such distinction, in what manner can it be said to exist? Question. What is an object in the absence of a frame of reference? Answer. It is everything conceivable at once. Is something that constitutes the union of all currently discriminable opposites. and something that cannot, therefore, be easily distinguished from nothing. I am not saying that there are no such things as things. That would, of course, be patently absurd. It is also fully apparent that the things we apprehend are rule-governed. The cosmos as we experience it is orderly and rationally comprehensible. What I am claiming is that objective things are in fact the product of an interaction between whatever constitutes our limited consciousness and whatever constitutes the unlimited background that makes up the world in the absence of a subject. This is a stance informed by mythology, in particular by myths of the origin. Archaic myths describing the ultimate origin concern themselves with representation of the source, not of objects in the modern sense, but of subjects and the experience of those subjects, some part of which can be regarded as objects. Such myths typically describe the genesis of the world of experience by relating the existence of a primordial god, portraying the division of this god into the world parents, and detailing the separation of those parents by their own son. This is the division of the hermaphroditic, all-encompassing, self-devouring, and nourishing serpent of chaos into earth/matter and sky/spirit, and the subsequent discrimination of those primordial opposing forces into identifiable aspects of being. The Indo-European myth of Indra and Vritra provides a representative example outlined by Iliada. The central myth of Indra, which is, furthermore, the most important myth in the Rig Veda, narrates his victorious battle against Vritra, the gigantic dragon who held back the waters in the hollow of the mountains. Strengthened by Soma, Indra lays the serpent low with his Vajra, thunderbolt, the weapon forged by Devastator, splits open his head and frees the waters, which pour into the sea like bellowing cows. The battle of a god against an ophidian or marine monster is well known to constitute a widespread mythological theme. We need only remember the struggle between Re and Apophis, between the Sumerian god Ninurta and Asag, Marduk and Tiamat, the Hittite storm god and the serpent Ilu-Yancas, Zeus and Typhon, the Iranian hero Thretona, and the three-headed dragon Ajidahaka. In certain cases, Marduk, Tiamat, for example, the god's victory constitutes the preliminary condition for the cosmogony. In other cases, the stake is the inauguration of a new era or the establishment of a new sovereignty, for example, Zeus, Typhon, or Baal, Yam. In short, it is by the slaying of an ophidian monster, symbol of the virtual, of chaos, but also of the autochthonous, that a new cosmic or institutional situation comes into existence. A characteristic feature, and one common to all these myths, is the fright or a first defeat of the champion. Marduk and Re hesitate before fighting. At the onset, the serpent Ilu-Yancas succeeds in mutilating the god. Typhon succeeds in cutting and carrying off Zeus's tendons. According to the Satapatha Brahmana, Indra, on first seeing Vritra, runs away as far as possible, and the Markandeya Purana describes him as sick with fear and hoping for peace. It would serve no purpose to dwell on the naturalistic interpretations of this myth. The victory over Vritra has been seen either as rain brought on by a thunderstorm, or as the freeing of the mountain waters, or as the triumphs of the sun over the cold that had imprisoned the waters by freezing them. Certainly, naturalistic elements are present, since the myth is multivalent. Indra's victory is equivalent, among other things, to the triumph of life over the sterility and death resulting from the immobilization of the waters by Vritra. But the structure of the myth is cosmogonic. In Rig Veda 133.4, it is said that, by his victory, the god created the sun, the sky, and dawn. According to another hymn, Indra, as soon as he was born, separated the sky from the earth, fixed the celestial vault, and, hurling the Vajra, tore apart Vritra, who was holding the waters captive in the darkness. Now, sky and earth are the parents of the gods. Indra is the youngest and also the last god to be born, because he put an end to the hierogamy, mystical union, of sky and earth. Quote, "By his strength he spread out these two worlds, sky and earth, and caused the sun to shine." End quote. After this demiurgic feat, Indra appointed Varuna a cosmocrator and guardian of Urta, which had remained concealed in the world below. There are other types of Indian cosmogonies that explain the creation of the world from a materia prima. This is not the case with the myth we have just summarized, for here a certain type of world already existed, for sky and earth were formed and had engendered the gods. Indra only separated the cosmic parents, and, by hurling the Vajra at Vritra, he put an end to the immobility, or even the virtuality, symbolized by the dragon's mode of being. Indra comes across Vritra, not divided, not awake, plunged in the deepest sleep, stretched out. According to certain traditions, the fashioner of the gods, Tvastar, whose role is not clear in the Rig Veda, had built himself a house and created Vritra as a sort of roof, but also as walls for his habitation. Inside this dwelling, encircled by Vritra, sky, earth, and the waters existed. Indra bursts asunder this primordial monad by breaking the resistance and inertia of Vritra. In other words, the world and life could not come to birth except by the slaying of an amorphous being. In countless variants, this myth is quite widespread.